Thank you. Well, this is actually the second Sunday school class I've taught this morning. I taught a class in Central Illinois at 7:30 this morning. And I've actually been doing that on an ongoing basis. You know, isn't it wonderful to be living in the 21st century where you can use things like Zoom technology to teach a class on the other side of the country? So, what was interesting about that class, it was a class where they're going through our video series on Navigating Genesis, and they brought me in for kind of a Q&A time at the end. But all the questions they ask are actually the topic of what we're doing here in class. I thought, wow, this is interesting. They wanted to know about all the other creation texts in the Bible. How do you interpret all those creation texts? And I said, that's exactly what we're doing in the Paradoxes class. We're actually going step by step through all the major creation texts in the Bible. And some of you have been long enough to realize we started this about 7 years ago. And where are we right now? We're in the book of Isaiah. So we're a little more than halfway through all these creation texts in the Bible, but doing it for a reason. Because they're saying, oh, they wanted me to address all these different interpretations on science and creation. And so I rattled off about 10 different ways of looking at science and creation in the Bible. And they said, how come there's so many different conflicting interpretations? And I said, well, typically it's because they focus on just one text. You need to be looking at all 66 books of the Bible, not just one. And they said, well, is it important to take it literally? It says, after all, there are passages in the Bible that are figurative, passages in the Bible that are metaphorical. And I said, well, usually you can spot the metaphors because it's got words like as and like. That's a tip-off that you're getting a metaphor. Or when Jesus was giving a parable, he actually says this is a parable. It's quite explicit. But it says in the topic of creation, you'd anticipate that the writers would be literal. And so yes, there are figurative passages in the Bible, but when it comes to the creation text, we would anticipate that they would be literal. But it's not, but to recognize, there's multiple literal interpretations of these creation texts, based on the fact that we're looking at a language that's got a much smaller vocabulary than English. And so don't be surprised if you get four different people with radically different views all saying they're taking it literally. But just as important, we have to take it consistently. If we really do believe that the Bible is inspired, authoritative, and inerrant, that means there will be no contradictions, say, between Leviticus and Genesis, or Romans and Genesis, or Psalms and Job. And so we look for an interpretation where we can read all these texts consistently without contradiction. And so they really glommed onto that, and they said, well, you know, where we're really stuck in this class is what happens when everything's done. And I said, well, that's exactly what we're talking about in Paradoxes right now. In fact, I got a handout here. It's called The End of the Universe Passages in the Book of Isaiah. And got them all written out for you. So let me back this up with, these are the study questions we're doing in the entire book of Isaiah. So if you don't have one, take one. If you got one, don't take one. I've actually now distributed 700 copies of these questions in this class. And I can tell you there's not 700 participants here. At least live. By the way, they're also available at our paradoxes.org website. And those of you that are new, just let you know there are cameras here because this class is live streamed. The participants in this class are not just those of you sitting in the chairs. Thanks to the internet, we got people literally around the world that participate in this class, and we let them ask questions. Last week, we had some questions from people that were participating. And incidentally, when you do ask a question here, and, you know, we are talking about the book of Isaiah right now and what it's got to say about the end of the universe and the end of Earth and what's going to come afterwards, you're free to ask a question on any topic at any time. Although I do appreciate you giving me the last few minutes to close things up. So, yeah, if you got a question, and it doesn't matter what the topic is, raise your hand. But wait for a microphone to come to you, because if people are live streaming, they want to hear your question. So please wait for the microphone, and someone will come to you with that. So yeah, we got those study questions being distributed, and I actually have the passages on the computer here. Wow, that's nice. Okay. This handout here actually has all the passages that I had on my computer last week that pertain to what the Bible says. And incidentally, this is not just the book of Isaiah. What we did is we went through the entire Bible and collected every passage that deals with the subject, what's going to happen to the universe? How is it going to end? And so if you don't have a copy of this, please take one. Let's see if you can get someone to distribute this for us. Any volunteer who can. And we've distributed these before, so if you already have a copy, let it go by. But if you don't have a copy, please take one of these. Okay. Yes, got a question.
We're talking about the end of the universe with these handouts, and just recently I saw something on the Science Live website. I don't really know much about that website, but they were saying that now some people think that dark matter pre-existed the Big Bang. The Big Bang happened, but dark matter pre-existed. Have you heard about that, Dr. Ross?
Yes. In fact, I just finished writing a blog that deals with some new measurements that put constraints on these speculations. Basically, what people are doing, theoretical physicists, they're speculating that dark energy and or dark matter may have much more exotic properties than what we're observing. And so based on those, they're basically speculating maybe it's got properties in such a way that instead of the universe having a single beginning, there's a prior period where the universe is collapsing, and then it transitions from a collapse to an expansion. And you actually see that in Hindu Vedas. They talk about how the universe goes through these cycles of a birth, death, and rebirth, dying again, and how in that context, the universe could be infinitely old. And people are saying, well, if it's infinitely old, maybe we don't need a creator to explain it. It's always been here. But one of the things you'll see in the fourth edition of The Creator and the Cosmos, and I'm addressing this in a blog that's coming out soon, is that, you know, irrespective of what we're measuring about the properties of dark matter and dark energy, it's simply not possible to join the geometry of a collapsing universe to the geometry of an expanding universe. It's based on the same principle about why wormholes won't work. How many of you have ever seen a science fiction movie where somebody goes through a wormhole into a different space-time realm? Mathematically, it's possible. Physically, it's impossible. Mathematically, it's possible because you could have a black hole over here, a black hole over here, and the singularity in those two black holes were to come together and perfectly touch one another, you could conceivably travel from the space-time realm of black hole A into the space-time realm of black hole B. The reason why physicists say this is physically impossible, the probability of getting the singularity of one black hole, keep in mind the singularity is an infinitesimally small volume. So you got this infinitely small volume having to make contact with another infinitely small volume. The probability of those two perfectly touching one another is zero. Moreover, the probability that even if they touch one another, they would be stable is also zero. It's going to immediately fall apart. And by the way, you wouldn't want to travel through a wormhole anyway, because as you begin to approach wormhole A, you notice that you get taller and taller. What's happening is the gravity of the black hole pulls more strongly on one part of your body than another part of your body, and the difference is such that it stretches your body out. You say, by how much? Well, as you begin to approach the event horizon, your body gets stretched out 3 miles long. In other words, you become a single line of particles. And as you go into the black hole, the particles get destroyed. And then you're not going to rebuild it. You know, this idea that you see in science fiction movies, you go in there, everything gets messed up, then it gets reconstructed, that can't happen. So, yeah, you can get an interesting book written by a physicist called The Physics of Star Trek, basically explaining why all the physics in Star Trek is wrong. So, beam me up, Scotty, isn't going to work. So, and you're not going to be able to go at a fast velocity. In fact, I got interviewed in a TV show just a few days ago where we're talking about the possibility of physical aliens or people like us traveling to another planetary system to here, and said, well, one reason we know that can't happen is that you cannot take an intelligent physical being and move them at the velocity of light. Because as you go through interstellar space, you're going to run into particles. Not many. Some parts of interstellar space, you only got one particle per every cubic meter. But if you're moving at a high velocity, you're going to be bumping into a bunch of them. And how high a velocity are we talking about? Well, if you move 1% the velocity of light, and you're traveling over 200 light years, your spaceship will be destroyed, and all the living beings on board will be destroyed. You're not going to make it. And we're talking 1% the velocity of light, and say you're traveling 300 light years, how long is it going to take you to go from your planetary system to our planetary system? Anybody got the mathematical acumen here to figure it out? Yes. 30,000 years. Interestingly, a decade ago, physicists said, okay, we're living at a time when technology is exploding. Now, given the resources that you would have on a planetary system, how long can you sustain technology at a level beyond what we experienced at the end of World War II? One paper said 1,000 years. The optimistic paper said 2,000 years. What happens is if you try to sustain technology at our level is you run out of resources. So money and technology aren't the issue, it's the availability of resources. And 30,000 years exceeds 2,000. You also got the problem is that if you're on a spaceship traveling to another planetary system, we're talking multiple generations. There's no guarantee that your great-grandchildren are going to be just as excited about going to this planet as you are. They may say, forget this, we're going back to where we were. There's that issue as well. Now, having said all that, there is a mission to visit the planets that are orbiting the nearest star. And they're going to go there at 20% the velocity of light. But they're not going to be sending monkeys. They're not going to be sending astronauts. The spaceships they're sending are 10 centimeters across. The smaller the spaceship, the lower the probability it's going to get destroyed. But even at 10 centimeters, they anticipate that if they send 1,000 of these 10-centimeter spaceships to the nearest star, Alpha Centauri, less than 500 will make it there and still be functional. But that's the plan. We're going to send 1,000 of these to Alpha Centauri because we want to see what the planets orbiting Alpha Proxima really look like. And we're going to send enough of them that a few of them will survive and give us some data. Now, we're not going to get a lot of data. You're not going to get much data from a 10-centimeter diameter spacecraft. But it does illustrate the point. You're not going to send a 6-foot-tall astronaut to another star system because there's enough stuff in interstellar space to rule that out. So hopefully I haven't entirely spoiled your enjoyment of Star Trek and all those other Star Wars type movies. As I said last week, what gets me about the Star Wars movies, they always start off with a galaxy far, far away. And we looked at galaxies far, far away. None of them are candidates. They need to change the script and make it our Milky Way galaxy, because it's really the only galaxy that has the appropriate characteristics to make our existence possible. I'm taking all the fun out of it. Kind of reminds me when my son said, Dad, we want to watch The Martian with you. And so we started watching Matt Damon walking across the desert on Mars, and I said, you can't walk that fast on Mars. You can't walk that far on Mars. It's only got 40% gravity. And then, of course, he was growing potatoes inside this tent. And I kept saying, you can't grow potatoes on Martian soil. It's got 60 times as much sulfur. And they said, well, Daddy's mixing his own poop with it. And I said, it has to be 100% human poop. And in that case, there's no way you can poop enough to grow enough potatoes to stay alive. And finally, they said, Dad, please stop telling us how many times this movie is violating the laws of physics. Just keep quiet. So I kept quiet for the rest of the movie. So yeah, don't watch a science fiction movie with me. All right. Because what I promised you last week is that I've actually developed some visuals to show you how astronomers think the universe actually will come to an end. And it's basically how this happens within 10 space dimensions. My visuals don't really do justice, but we'll give it a try, because people are telling me words just don't do it justice. So let's see if these visuals work. But before we go there, let me quickly review the relevant scripture passage. And this is really an exhaustive list. We actually went through the entire Bible and picked up every passage that's relevant to the end of the universe. And one motivation for this is there's a theological debate going on seminary campuses. And I just came back from speaking on a seminary campus. And the debate is this. Is our eternal home going to be on this planet Earth, where God basically repairs the planet and makes it the way it was supposed to be from the beginning? After all, we humans have been put in charge of this planet Earth because of our sin and evil. We've made a terrible job of it. Christ is going to come back, restore everything, and we get to spend eternity here. And based on people picking two passages of Scripture where Jesus says he's going to restore all things. But we heard the sermon this morning. Whenever you see a sentence that says that women can't speak, for example, well, let's see what he really meant by speaking. And those of you who are in the sermon this morning realize, okay, it's basically a command to wives, don't publicly embarrass your husband in church. If he's speaking, don't run up on the stage and interrupt him. Talk to him at home. Now, my wife does that. Every time she hears me speak, she takes notes and everything I said that needs to be corrected, and she will deal with that at home. I mean, it's that whole philosopher's question. If a man is alone in a forest and his wife is not with him, is he still wrong? So, and of course, that command applies to husbands as well. I mean, don't embarrass your wife publicly in church. If you've got an issue, take it up with her privately. But likewise, when it says that Jesus is going to restore all things, what does it mean by restore all things? And if all you've got is this one sentence, don't try to apply that sentence to say that means that this universe is going to exist forever, the earth is going to exist forever. At least you want to look at the entire Bible and see what it actually says about the universe and the earth. So we've actually done that in this class, and I know a lot of you are new, so I'm going to quickly go through these passages again. So let's pull this up here. Psalm 102 is the first passage of the Bible that explicitly talks about the end of the universe as opposed to the beginning. Actually, it talks about both. In the beginning, you, God, laid the foundations of the earth, and the heavens are the work of your hands. They will perish, but you remain. They will wear out like a garment. Like clothing, you will change them, and they will be discarded. But you remain the same, and your years will never end. So it's basically making the point, God is eternal. The universe is not eternal. There will come a time when it will be discarded. And then we have here in Isaiah, verse chapter 34, verse 4, all the stars of the heaven, and there are 50 billion trillion of them, a lot of stars. If somebody tries to name a star after you, keep in mind you can name 7 trillion stars after every human being and not run out. Don't spend $54. And incidentally, here's a trivia question. How many stars sold by the Star Registry, where they name a star after you, are recognized by the International Astronomical Union?
None.
That's the right answer. Zero. Save your money. Okay. All the stars of heaven will be dissolved, and the sky rolled up like a scroll. All the starry hosts will fall like withered leaves from the vine, like shriveled figs from the fig tree. So once again, it's a declaration that the stars we see in the sky are not eternal. There come a time when they will be rolled up, and it's basically implying that maybe even the space-time dimensionality will be rolled up. Isaiah 51, verse 6, "Lift upon your eyes to the heaven. Look at the earth beneath. The heavens will vanish like smoke. The earth will wear out like a garment, and its inhabitants die like flies. But my salvation will last forever. My righteousness will never fail." So again, it's a hint here that God created the universe with salvation and righteousness in mind. You actually see that in Psalm 97, verse 6. The heavens declare the righteousness of God. They declare his glory, and they declare his righteousness, and all peoples have seen it. That righteousness and salvation will be forever, not the case for the universe. And Isaiah 65, 17, "Behold, I will create the new heavens and a new earth. The former things will not be remembered, nor will they come to mind." Now, I think what's driving, in fact, I've read a lot of these books written by theologians claiming that our eternity is going to be here on planet Earth. And what I see in the writings, they're appealing to just how beautiful our planet is. Now, you know me. I love to spend my vacations going to extraordinarily beautiful places. I love the mountains. I love the waterfalls, the animals. But notice what this passage is saying. As beautiful and as gorgeous our planet Earth is, God's going to take us to a place that's so much more beautiful and gorgeous, we won't even remember all these wonderful places on our bucket list that we visited when we're here on Earth. They won't even come to mind. And that, again, is in context with 1 Corinthians 2:9. No one can think or even imagine how wonderful and great and glorious the reward we'll experience in new creation will be. And then Isaiah 66:22, "The new heavens and the new earth that I will make will endure before me, declares the Lord." So it's basically saying the first creation, namely our universe, yes, it's been around for 13.8 billion years, but it's not eternal. The new creation that will replace it will be eternal. And then here's a simple statement in Matthew 24. Heaven and earth will pass away. They got a question? Okay.
It said that the former things will not be remembered when a new heaven and earth is created.
Right.
Wouldn't we count as former things?
Yes, we count as former things. And so anything that God creates that's spiritual continues to exist for the rest of eternity. That includes all human beings. It includes all angels. They don't all wind up in the same place. God gives you a choice of where you're going to spend eternity, but we are all eternal. So in that sense, in the new creation, you're going to be with beings that are part of the first creation. But what you're going to experience in new creation is going to be so wonderful. It's like you won't be saying, "Oh, I sure miss visiting the San Diego Zoo." Okay? That's something that's not going to come to mind.
Yeah.
Niagara Falls. I wish we could go back to Niagara Falls. Again, that won't come to mind because of just what you're experiencing in the new creation. That's the context. Yes, are you going to remember, "Oh, I saw you back"? Yeah. I mean, I think it's going to be really terrific when each one of us dies. There's going to be this welcoming ceremony, and all these people who knew you in this life are going to be there, and there's going to be a massive reunion. I mean, research on near-death experiences basically assert that that's the first thing you experience when you die as a Christian. You have this incredible reunion celebration with the people that have died ahead of you. And that's just the beginning. But it's going to be so incredible that Niagara Falls won't come to mind. The San Diego Zoo is not even going to, forget all that. And, you know, we kind of get prideful about what we've done here on Earth, but it's nothing compared to what's going to happen. Excuse me. Let me turn this off.
People
with my asthma, get that all taken care of in the morning, but sometimes it comes back. Okay, Hebrews 1, verses 10 to 12. In the beginning, O Lord, you laid the foundations of the earth, and the heavens are the work of your hands. They will perish, but you remain. They will wear out like a garment. You'll roll them up like a robe. Like a garment they will be changed, but you remain the same, and your years will never end. So it's basically repeating what we see in Psalm 102, endless passages in Isaiah. Then we have this in Hebrews 12. God, namely He has promised, once more I will shake not only the earth, but also the heavens. The words once more indicate the removing of what can be shaken, that is, created things, so that what cannot be shaken may remain. Therefore, since we are receiving a kingdom that cannot be shaken, let us be thankful and so worship God acceptably with reverence and awe. So it's basically making a promise that the new creation, there's not going to be any major disturbance. It really is going to continue in a wonderful state forever. And then 2 Peter 3:7, the present heavens and earth are reserved for fire, being kept for the day of judgment and the destruction of ungodly men. And 2 Peter 3:10, but the day of the Lord will come like a thief. The heavens will disappear with a roar. The elements will be destroyed by fire, and the earth and everything in it will be burned up. So what we're seeing in all these passages, specifically to exactly how the universe will come to an end, it's going to be very hot when it comes to an end. And it's going to be very quick. It's going to be very quick, very hot, and it's all going to be rolled up. So this vast universe is going to be kind of squished up into a little ball, and it's all going to disappear. And it'll happen when it's all worn out. So those are the four features we can get here from this. Let me exit this and bring up for you the visuals that I'd promised. Let me see here. Here we go. What happened to my cursor? Okay. This is one model of Big Bang cosmology. And most Big Bang cosmologists focus on the beginning of the universe. There's a small subset of Big Bang cosmologists that are actually addressing the question, how the universe will come to an end. And they picked up this Greek word ekpyrotic, which means the universe came out of fire and will return to fire. Kind of what you see in that those passages we just read out of 2 Peter. And the model basically is saying that the universe exists on a huge sheet. I mean, think of the universe as somewhat analogous to planet Earth. Planet Earth is a three-dimensional body, but where do all the human beings live on that three-dimensional body? We all live on the two-dimensional surface of the three-dimensional Earth. In the case of the universe, all the stars and galaxies, all the matter, energy, space, and time itself is constrained to the three-dimensional surface of the four-dimensional universe. Now, astronomers have been measuring the geometry of the universe for about the past 20 years. I write about that in the fourth edition of The Creator and the Cosmos, how they now know it has a flat geometry to within four places of the decimal. In fact, what's really interesting is we keep coming up with better tools for measuring the geometry of the universe. We're now right at the limit. If the universe indeed is flat, a flat universe model actually limits the degree to which you can prove it's flat to about four places of the decimal. And that's where we are right now. We might get another 20 or 30% improvement, but if we are correct that the universe is flat, we're never going to be able to prove it's perfectly flat. But it's close to being flat. When I define flat, okay. The way astronomers define flatness is, okay, if the universe has a closed surface, it's kind of like an ellipsoid or a sphere. If it's got an open gem, which means if it's got a closed surface, the universe eventually will stop expanding. If it's going to continue to expand at a faster and faster rate, we call that an open universe, which means instead of being shaped in three dimensions like a sphere or an ellipsoid, it's shaped like a horse saddle, where you've got these parabolas that go out, and they can literally go out to infinity. And so that's what's referred to as an open universe. A flat universe is one that's neither open nor closed, it's perfectly flat, which means it's going to continue expanding, but it's going to continue expanding at a rate that doesn't hit infinity. And so, and then when we're talking a flat universe, we're talking about it being flat in 10 dimensions, not just length, width, height, and time. Now, my diagrams are visually limited. It's impossible to visualize phenomena in dimensions we don't experience. And so there's no way I can show you 10 dimensions with a bunch of slides and have it accurate. So what I've done here is shown you two dimensions. Just pretend that that two-dimensional rectangle you'll see there is 10 dimensions. Now, another feature of these 10 dimensions, you've got one time dimension and three large space dimensions. We got a question?
Hugh, why do you feel this is an important doctrine? What difference does it make whether the universe is replaced or renewed?
Okay. I think what's making this an important doctrine is this relatively recent theological movement that's taking place, which basically is saying we're not really appreciating our planet Earth to the degree that God wants us to appreciate it. And we've made a mess of it. I mean, the environmental thing that's crept into Christian theology is basically making the point when Christ comes back, he's going to restore all things. Now, one thing we haven't touched on yet that we're going to be looking at is doctrines of the end times, where you've got a millennial reign of Christ here on planet Earth for 1,000 years, and then people say there will be no millennium. We're kind of been, the millennium is a figure of speech, and we're kind of in it right now. I mean, you can get books on three views on the millennium. I have a book called Four Views on the Millennium. There's one that's five views on the millennium. They can't even agree on how many different views there are. But, you know, I mean, the whole point really centers on, okay, when Christ comes back to planet Earth, is he going to be ruling here on planet Earth for all of eternity, or is it a temporary period of, say, 1,000 years? And then people basically saying, because we Christians are not appreciating the beauty of the planet, we need to realize this is our eternal home. And, you know, one recent book that got published by an apologist who lives in a really pretty part of North America says, you know, this place is so gorgeous, I can't imagine not enjoying it for all eternity. God's not going to take this away from me. And so that's why I'm kind of looking at this. Well, maybe God could take it away from you, but there's a biblical principle. God never takes something away from you without giving you something much, much better to replace it. And, you know, one of the questions I got from the class I taught in Illinois earlier today was, well, you know what? I'm really attached to my pets. Are they not going to be with me in heaven? And I said, well, there's some passages which would indicate that the only creatures that God creates that exist for eternity are spiritual creatures. And there's passages in the Bible that seem to be quite explicit that we're the only spirit beings that God created here on earth. And so, yes, I know you've got this really strong relationship with your pet dog, but your pet dog, according to the Bible, is not a spiritual being. And they said, I can't imagine life without my pet dog. And I said, well, who says there won't be animals in the new creation? I mean, there's a passage in Revelation 21 about God creating kingdoms. I think if you read that text, those kingdoms are not referring to us. It's referring to what other things God's going to be creating. And so I'm not saying there won't be pets in heaven. I'm saying if there are pets in heaven, they're going to be way better than the pets we got here. And, you know, I've had certain pets I'm not sure I want to be with me in heaven. So of all the pets went to heaven, I think that wouldn't be quite as pleasant as we could imagine. But, and for what it's worth, I've had some pets in my life that I have a very strongly bonded to, and it's like, you know, not ever seeing them again. That's a loss. But I think there's a spiritual message in that. Namely, that God on purpose designed these animals to form very strong emotional bonds with us. And they're not sinners. So when they bond to us, they serve and please us without barriers, without conditions. And consequently, that causes us to reach out to them. But notice this, when we abuse these animals, they run away from us. And, you know, if you wonder why, when you go out into the national parks or outside the national parks especially, the animals run away, they know we humans aren't safe. And so they run away. But there's a lesson there. Our sin not only causes these animals to run away from us, our sin causes us to run away from God. Just like they run away from us, we run away from God. And as I shared with the class this morning, I says, notice it takes a higher being to tame these animals. Likewise, it takes a higher being to tame us. And we need to come to God for that taming that we all need. That's how the book of Job ends, where he says, you've tamed all these animals, but there's one species of life you can't tame, and that's a proud human heart. It takes me to do that. And if you ask me, I'll do it. And many of us have done that, and we're kind of surprised at how severe can be. Okay, but it's wonderful. Anyway, that's why we're addressing this, because I think we have a problem today in underestimating the reward that God's going to give us. It's not just going to be this restored planet. And in debating some of these theologians, I said, well, how many people do you think have lived on planet Earth? And a lot of them have this idea that most of the people who ever lived on Earth are alive today. Well, I did see a billboard that if you're over 70, you're in a group where most people over 70 have ever lived are alive today. That's just because of our modern medicine and of our high standard of living that is true. But that's not true of the whole population. And the minimum estimate calculation for how many people have ever lived is 100 billion. That's the lowest estimate of the total number of people who've ever lived. The highest is up around 200 billion. In my opinion, the most reasonable answers are somewhere around 130 to 150 billion people. Okay, if you're claiming that planet Earth is our eternal home, that means not too many people are going to get saved. Because there's no way, for example, if you had a quarter of the world's population saved, and we're talking 160 billion people have ever lived, that's 40 billion people living here on planet Earth. I got to attend a lecture at a science theology conference where a technologist calculated the maximum population this planet can sustain at a standard of living that's the average of what we have here in the United States. The answer shocked everybody. It's only 1 billion. In other words, we simply can't sustain 7.5 billion people at the standard of living that we experience here in the United States. It's not sustainable. We would quickly run out of resources. And so to actually have, say, people enjoying a high standard of living with technology for thousands of years, our population can't exceed 1 billion. Well, if it's only 1 billion out of 160 billion, how come the Great Commission wasn't fulfilled thousands of years ago? I mean, we still have Christ waiting to come back because we haven't fulfilled the Great Commission. And I think conservatively, we would have to argue that at least 10, maybe 15% of the entire human population today are committed followers of Jesus Christ. So we just use that percentage alone. Our planet simply can't be the eternal home. It's simply not big enough. And that's something you see in Revelation 21. The new earth is declared there to be far bigger than our present earth. Now, frankly, I think it's in different dimensions. So what does bigger mean? Okay, we've got a question here. And I'm going to get to these diagrams, so.
Please forgive me, but I'm still unclear as to how you determine the percentage of the total world's population that will be saved. Is there some verses that say that, or?
Well, the only we got a few verses. Okay. Number one, Jesus says it will not be a majority. Yeah. You know, narrow is the door that leads to salvation. So that's always a good incentive not to gain too much weight because the door is going to be narrow, right? No, that's out of context. But the whole point is, and there's a clear reference where you know the passage is a metaphor. Jesus says, I am the door. He's not a physical door. He's a doorway to a new life.
So you're saying it's less than 50%?
It's less than 50% based on that text. Okay. And actually, if you read it carefully, it's somewhat less than 50%. But then you go to Zechariah 13, which tells you a day will come when one-third of all the Jews living at that time will become followers of Jesus Christ. So at least for the Jews, it seems like the number is roughly in the area of one-third. We got passages in the Bible that says that God's going to treat the Gentiles in the same way as the Jews. So it indicates that the percentage is probably in the neighborhood of a quarter to a third for all humanity. And we know it's got to be a significant fraction because the Great Commission's not yet been fulfilled. So the fact that we've got a high percentage of the world's population today that are visible, committed followers of Jesus Christ, again, argues that it's going to be a lot more than 10%. But it's not going to be 50%. Yeah, thank you. So on that basis, if there's been, say, 140 billion people that have lived on the face of the earth, obviously our planet Earth cannot be our eternal home. No, I mean, if it's 0.5%, Jesus would have been here, 1,800 years ago. So, and the percentage of people who have been serious followers of Jesus Christ has been consistently increasing. You know, Ralph Winter, when he was alive, would be an occasional member of this class, and he's the one that said, yes, if you simply look at how people identify themselves, are you Christian? Yeah, I'm a Christian. He says, if you look at that percentage with respect to time, it goes up and down. But he says, of all you look at are people that are visibly, faithfully committed followers of Jesus Christ in the sense that they're committed to bring other people to faith in Jesus Christ. He says, that percentage, based on the world's population, has always gone up. It's never gone down. And he wrote that making the point that ever since Jesus rose bodily from the dead, progress towards the fulfillment of the Great Commission has always been increasing, never decreasing. But he also wrote it making the point, we're not yet there. In spite of all the people who have come to faith in Christ, we're not there yet. But that makes the point, we're not looking at a majority, but we're looking at a large minority. It's going to be more than 20%. I'm guessing somewhere between, say, 30 and 40% will be the fulfillment of the Great Commission.
You?
Yeah.
I have a question regarding astronomy and astrology and physics. I have a sister in Christ who is very well-versed in the Word of God, and I know she loves God, but she brings astrology and astronomy and ties it in with physics a lot. And, you know, I know that she does know Christ, but yet she connects all of this together because maybe she has a love for science as well. But I do know that the Bible says not to touch celestial things in terms of astrology and, you know, the occult. So how can we break that down in a way where we're not harming that person's faith, but explaining to them the difference between all of these different subjects that they're intertwining together?
Well, that's a good question, and often people confuse astrology and astronomy. I know that personally because when I speak to lay audiences, I'm more frequently introduced as an astrologer than I am an astronomer. I'm also more frequently introduced as a cosmetologist rather than a cosmologist. So there's confusion at that level as well. In fact, there was one time where I was sharing the platform with an actual cosmologist, and they got our introductions mixed up. So, and I remember there's one lady coming up to me afterwards. That's the most complex talk I've ever heard in cosmetology. I had no idea. It had references to the universe. So, But the universe is beautiful too. So I think cosmetology really does apply to cosmology. The universe is beautiful, and that God has kept it beautiful. Now, we have at Reasons to Believe a three-page paper titled Astrology, Science, or What? Which basically identifies the American problem of people thinking astrology's got a scientific basis. And so basically they're confusing astrology and astronomy. So I wrote this paper showing the clear distinctions between astrology and astronomy and why we have passages in the Old Testament that basically tell us, stay away from astrology. But I find the best way of convincing Americans that they need to stay away from astrology is first show them that it has no possible scientific basis. I mean, if you know anything about astrology, it's basically saying the moment you come out of your mother's womb determines the rest of your life. And that's because of where the stars and planets are at the time that you come out of the womb. And you know, number one is, why is that moment of coming out of the womb so significant compared to the time of conception? Or compared to the time when you're 1 year old? You know, why pick that precise moment? And moreover, astrologers try to claim, well, at the moment you're born, you come out of the womb, and now you're under the gravitational influence of the planets. So where those planets are determines everything. Well, you can easily calculate the gravitational influence of the planets on that newborn baby, and it's not much. Matter of fact, the gravity exerted by the father or by the obstetrician is orders of magnitude greater than any possible gravitational influence of the planets. So basically showing people this can't possibly have a scientific basis helps. But also revealing to them, we're not the only spiritual beings that God created. God also created angels. And these angels, unlike us, are not subject to the laws of physics. And so we can't travel at the velocity of light. They can, because they're not physical beings. And it tells us in Hebrews 13, many of us have entertained angels unawares. But it's referring to Christians who are having assists by the righteous angels. You see at the beginning of Hebrews 1 that God has these angels that are under God's control and are righteous. He sends them to assist us in our ministries. And you see examples of that in the book of Acts. And I actually wrote in our book, Always Be Ready, it's happening today. It's even happening in American Christian lives. So this happens. But we also get visits from the angels that are not righteous. And, you know, there's a book back there called Lights in the Sky and Little Green Men, because typically how they visit people today are through, quote, flying saucers and UFOs. However, if you visit Ireland, they come as leprechauns. So these fallen angels can come to us in any form they please. But they typically come to us in forms designed to deceive us. And so, for example, in the UFO phenomena, they'll say, we're from another planetary system, and we're highly advanced, and we've got some information to share with you that will help you. And typically how the demons operate, they say, we're going to give you knowledge, and we're going to give you power, but at the cost of truth. The righteous angels, their motivation is to give you truth. So that's how you distinguish. That's why it says in 1 John 4, test the spirits to see where they're from. We are going to get visits from these spiritual beings, but put them to the test. For example, I'm fully convinced that Joseph Smith was visited by an angel. I'm also fully convinced that Muhammad was visited by an angel. I'm convinced by the similarity between the Quran and the Mormon scriptures that they both got the same angel visiting them. And what do we see in John? He says these angels, these fallen angels, will come to us as angels of light. And they come to deceive. They pretend to be righteous when in fact they are not. And this happened in my own family. My paternal grandmother was a spiritualist for 50 years. And she claimed that she was talking to angels all the time. I said, well, how do you talk? And she said, they call me on the phone. And, you know, I wasn't a Christian at that time, so I was kind of snarky. And I said, well, who pays the phone bill? Do they pay the phone bill? Does it show up in your phone bill? And she wasn't very happy with that. But I kept talking to her about it, and she had this assumption, all angelic visits are benevolent. They're all coming from the righteous angels. And I see that with people that are trapped in astrology. They think they're getting messages, communications, and relationships with the righteous angels, when in fact they're the fallen angels. And again, the thing to do is you've got to put it to the test. And what I write about in Lights and Sky and Little Green Men, the only way these unrighteous angels can come into your life is if you invite them. And you invite them through occult activity. You invite them through having occult articles in your possession. And it can be as subtle as having a close relative that has open doors to the occult. In fact, I know that because of my grandmother, other relatives were impacted and weren't necessarily involved in the occult. But there's a positive point here. If you close the doors, this will go away. So people tell me they're having all these close encounters with UFOs. Well, tell me, what are you doing? And I kind of go down through the things that are happening in life. So if you get this, this, and this out of your life, that will be the end of your UFO encounters. If you don't believe me, put it to the test. And I think the real test is this. Where you see a high level of astrology being practiced, you see a high level or high percentage of people that come under the influence of these fallen angels. When I went to the Soviet Union, when it was still being run by the communists, very high percentage of the Russian population were into astrology, and even higher percentage were having these close encounters with UFOs. Now then, the communists are no longer running the show, those percentages have plummeted. Because basically, there's been a walk away from occult physics. Occult physics was a big thing in the Soviet era. But now that universities no longer have departments of occult physics, we've seen a plummeting of those kinds of experiences. So I think that's the thing you need to share. This is scientifically testable. If you open the doors, bad things are going to happen to you. Close the doors, that's going to go away. And if you've got a close relative that's not closing the door, confess what they're doing to the Lord in prayer as being displeasing to Him. That will cut the link. That's what we did in our family. We confessed what my grandmother was doing. By the way, at age 86, just a few months before she passed, my grandmother gave her life to Jesus Christ. But what it took was persuading her not all angels are benevolent. There are wicked angels, and you need to put them to the test. And then we just kind of went through some of her experience and says, Grandma, that was not a benevolent experience. Look what it did to you. And so she finally acknowledged, yes, I've been dealing with the wrong kinds of angels. And so she repented and gave her life to Christ and passed within a few months after that. So, and incidentally, that was a big breakthrough to my parents becoming Christians, seeing what happened to her, because her personality changed after she became a Christian. It was wonderful. Okay, a little bit off target. How much time do I got left? Well, I got plenty of time. Let's get into this geometry of how the universe will end. And by the way, when I talk about the ekpyrotic Big Bang creation model, it's not the only ekpyrotic model. Several years ago, I'm going to give you the simplest one, but there's actually many of these models that exist today. But I think the key thing to remember, and this ties in, we're looking at these texts in 2 Peter, is that in addition to the three big space dimensions of length, width, and height, there are six tiny space dimensions. The universe is nine dimensions of space, and nine dimensions of space expanded rapidly from the cosmic creation event. When gravity separated away from the other three forces of physics, and this is a principle in physics, the hotter you make the universe, the more compact you make the universe, the fewer fundamental laws of physics you have. Today we got four, but if you go back, there's a time when there was only three, then only two, and only one. And we can actually demonstrate this to some extent in particle physics experiments, where you basically duplicate the high energy density conditions the universe had when it was very young. And so it's been done since the 1970s, where you can actually do an experiment in a particle accelerator and show if you make the energy density high enough, the electromagnetic force fuses with the weak nuclear force. They call it the electroweak force. If you want another example that's a little more familiar to some of you, if you take a bar magnet and heat it up, the magnetism will disappear. Cool it down, the magnetism returns. What's happening is it's getting so hot, the magnetic energy and the heat energy blend together. Well, likewise, if you make the universe small enough and hot enough, like it was when it was extremely young, the forces of physics come together. But what we've also learned is when you start off with this one force and it separates into the strong electroweak force and the force of gravity, it's at that moment that six of the nine dimensions of space stop expanding. You say, has this been proven? The answer is no. We don't have a particle accelerator powerful enough to actually duplicate that condition, and we never will. You would need a particle accelerator bigger than the entire universe to put that to the test, and no one's going to fund that anywhere in the near future. So, but we do know that unless the universe had nine dimensions of space, where six stopped expanding when gravity separated out from the other forces of physics, today we'd have a universe where quantum mechanics would contradict general relativity, where quantum mechanics would contradict gravity, and life would be impossible. So the fact that you're sitting here in this classroom is proof that the universe began with nine space dimensions, where six stopped expanding when gravity separated out. Now, a lot of people are confused and saying, well, Hugh, are you saying that string theory is the answer to what's going on in particle physics? String theory is one of many theories that's in this nine-dimensional frame. So I'm not saying that string theory is the correct answer to particle physics. It might be, but there are other models that also fit in with this nine-dimensional concept. But I think we can be confident. And by the way, this was all done 15 years ago at Caltech, and done by people who were actually members of our class at that time. There were atheists and Christians, theoretical physicists, working together on the first discovery of these nine dimensions of space. But the picture here I want you to imagine, and you're not going to be able to visualize it, but that rectangle that goes up there, think of it as a 10 space-time dimensional sheet. And you say, how can I visualize these six other dimensions? Well, keep in mind they stopped expanding when the universe was only 10 to the minus 43 seconds old. That's 1/10 millionth of a trillionth of a trillionth. Have I got enough trillionths in there? 1/10 millionth of a trillionth of a trillionth of a trillionth of a second old. That's when they stopped expanding. In other words, those dimensions are no bigger today than they were at that early moment. How big are we talking about? The total cross-section of any one of those six dimensions is 20 orders of magnitude smaller than the diameter of an electron. So that's probably why you haven't noticed them. And say, so where are they? They're wrapped very tightly around the three big dimensions. I mean, a good way to visualize this is think of a sheet of paper, and you can roll it up like a scroll, kind of like this. If I roll it up tightly enough, that two dimensions now looks like a line. And what's happening is those six tiny space dimensions are rolled up around the three big dimensions, kind of like this little scroll here, but the cross-section of the scroll is literally 10 to the 20 times smaller than the diameter of an electron. But if that weren't true, we wouldn't be here today. If that weren't true, you couldn't have general relativity, gravity, and quantum mechanics coexisting with one another. And that's how it was discovered. These theoretical physicists at Caltech said there simply isn't enough room within three dimensions of space for all the symmetries demanded by quantum mechanics, general relativity, and gravity. But they also discerned that you can have too much room. If you've got 10 space dimensions or 11 space dimensions, it doesn't work. If you've got 8, it doesn't work. It has to be exactly 9. It took them 12 years to figure that out, but that's another story. So think of it that way. Now, the universe of today is much bigger than the universe we see. And it's because we live in an expanding universe. So when we look towards the beginning of the universe, we're looking back 13.8 billion years. I mean, this little map I showed you here, that's the map of the universe when it was only 380,000 years old. We get that map by looking at the universe 13.8 billion light years away. That's a time when galaxies didn't exist, stars didn't exist. It's the time when we do first begin to see distinctions between hot spots and cold spots. All those little orange spots you see there become future clusters of galaxies. The blue spots, those are the cold spots, they become the voids between the clusters of galaxies. And to show you how sensitive to this, the temperature difference between the hottest orange or red spot and the coldest blue spot is a little more than 1/100,000th of a degree. So the temperature differences there are extremely tiny. Now, the universe of today has expanded much more than the universe we see through the telescope, because when we look far away, we're looking back in time. You're looking back in time when the universe was smaller than it is now. Now, based on the expansion rate of the universe, we can calculate how big the present universe must be. And the answer is it must be a minimum of 47 times bigger than the universe we can see through the telescope. So that's kind of why I put this picture up there. I mean, you've got the universe that we can see, and then the universe that we know must exist. And incidentally, depending on the geometry of the universe, it could be much bigger than 47 times more than what we can see through the telescope. So years ago, astronomers said, well, we could actually hypothesize, in this case, how the universe might come to an end. And this is one of many models about how the universe could come to an end. But what's interesting about the ekpyrotic Big Bang model, it actually predicts an end to the universe that's relatively recent. I mean, one thing we know for sure, if the universe were to continue to expand under dark energy, where it expands faster and faster as every year goes by, a time will come when the universe expands so rapidly it tears apart the electrons and the protons. That's called the Big Rip, where everything rips, and when you rip apart all the fundamental particles, you rip apart the space and time, the universe simply ends. All the space-time dimensionality disappears. Now, the problem with that model from a biblical perspective, that's not going to happen under any conception or measure of the universe until the universe is more than 10 to the 1,000 years old. Okay, that's 1,000 zeros after the one. You know, as I read my Bible, it looks like we're going to enter the new creation a little sooner than that. So this is where the ekpyrotic model comes in, because it actually predicts an end to the universe that's not nearly an infinite time off into the future. But yeah, if nothing were to happen, the Big Rip would bring an end to the universe. That in itself shows that the universe cannot be our eternal home in its present state. Because as the universe keeps expanding, you will get a Big Rip. If you want to read the technical details, just put Big Rip into the search engine at reasons.org. It'll pop up an article that I wrote a couple of years ago on why the universe is ultimately doomed in any conception of the universe under its present laws of physics. But in this particular model, you've got this flat sheet, but it curls in on itself beyond what we can see. So at the bottom part of the extreme left there, you see the universe that we can see. And this is this 10-dimensional sheet that goes out really far and then curls back in on itself, such that this 10-dimensional sheet that you saw back here, it basically goes, well, maybe a model like this. Here's a sheet, and it basically does this. And so you've got a 10-dimensional sheet just over top of another 10-dimensional sheet. And this is a sheet where you've got space-time fluctuations happening at a quantum level. And hopefully I got time to talk a little bit about that. If not, we'll do it next time. But think of this as a sheet that's got little ripples in it, in the sense that the space-time dimensionality is 10 space-time dimensionality, has these very tiny space-time ripples going on. And we know these ripples exist because we see what are called virtual particles. virtual particles form, where you've got this tiny vibrating quantum space-time foam in the space-time dimensionality of the universe, and that instability in those space-time fluctuations actually produce particles. But we call them virtual particles because according to the laws of quantum mechanics, they return to the space-time fabric before we can actually grab them and keep them. So we know these virtual particles don't remain long in existence. The Heisenberg uncertainty principle tells us they have to return to the space-time surface before we actually are able to keep that particle. But we see phenomena going on that proves that this is actually happening. But in this particular model, you've got these very tiny quantum space-time fluctuations which basically bubble up above the surface and below the surface. So if you put these two overlapping surfaces close enough together, so you've got the sheet here like that, and you put them very close together, there comes a moment when the top part of the sheet is so close to the bottom part of the sheet that a quantum space-time fluctuation in the bottom sheet can make contact with this quantum space-time fluctuation in the top sheet. If that were to happen, then the entire space-time dimensionality of the universe disappears into that contact point. And it causes the entire universe to greatly heat up. I mean, it becomes infinitely hot, and all the space-time dimensionality disappears, and the universe is gone forever. So, sounds a lot like what we read in 2 Peter, what we read in the book of Isaiah, what we read in Psalms, where it talks about God rolling it up like a scroll, and it all disappearing in a fiery heat. In one moment, it's all gone. I mean, literally, this would be nearly instantaneous that this would happen. Okay, what ekpyrotic Big Bang creation model theorists have done is to actually calculate how close together does the top part of the sheet need to be to the bottom part of the sheet for there to be a possibility within, say, a 20 billion year span of time for a quantum space-time fluctuation on the bottom sheet to make contact with one on the top sheet. We don't have a definitive answer because it still depends on the geometry of the universe and especially depends on how much the space-time surface fluctuates. The good news is there are measurements being made right now that are determining the magnitude of those space-time fluctuations, or at least putting limits on those space-time fluctuations. But if the fluctuations are as large as what some theoreticians think they might be, all you need to do is have the top part of the surface above the bottom part of the surface, where the top part is about a millimeter away from the bottom part, and there's a probability of 50% that within 20 billion years, you'd have a quantum space-time fluctuation making contact with one from the top sheet, with one on the bottom sheet, and the whole universe would disappear. So that's kind of mind-boggling to think about, that part of this vast universe that we're observing is just a millimeter above us in a dimension we can't access because there is no space dimension between the bottom sheet and the top sheet. You've got to stick with the sheet. So it could be that close to us and we wouldn't even know it. Okay, I got a few minutes left. Last week I talked about a scientific discovery where we've actually been looking at the orbit of a really big star, 14 times the mass of our star, the Sun, orbiting the supermassive black hole that's in the middle of our galaxy. What I didn't share with you last week is the research paper, and by the way, there's a blog coming out on September 9th where I'm going to talk about this in some detail. And it's probably going to be two articles because it was a little longer than what our editors wanted. But I said all these details have got to be in here for lay people to get the point. But the paper ends where they place a limit on how big those quantum space-time fluctuations can be. So we know there are space-time quantum fluctuations, but they know that they're small enough where it's probably got to be a little bit closer than a millimeter away. Because if it's a millimeter away, then we should be seeing those quantum space-time fluctuations. What I write about in the article that's going to be coming out in September is that, by the way, this is already September, isn't it? So 8 more days, okay. is that we already know that these quantum space-time fluctuations are small enough to eliminate the speculations by theoretical physicists who say maybe we can have a quantum eternity theorem, basically speculating we've got these huge quantum space-time fluctuations that in one context would allow us to escape the beginning of the universe. And I think that answers a question that came up at the beginning of class. What about this new exotic model of dark energy? Again, it's founded on this idea we're going to have really big quantum space-time fluctuations. Apparently, the quantum space-time fluctuations are not that large due to this one experiment. And as I write about in The Creator and the Cosmos, fourth edition, we've got other observations also establishing the quantum space-time fluctuations are not big enough to sustain these new atheistic speculations about the universe. The universe really does have a beginning. And that's relevant to our class, because remember we started off our study in Isaiah, looking at everything Isaiah says about the start of the universe. And notice how explicit it was. It has a definitive, explicit beginning, and now this new research is basically giving us more evidence for that. My colleague Jeff Zwirink just published a book on this controversy over the beginning of the universe, but he basically makes the point in his new book, we'll never get rid of all the speculations. People can always speculate something beyond what we can know and measure. But what's interesting is the more we know and measure about the universe, the stronger evidence we get that the universe really does have a beginning, exactly like the Bible describes. And just days ago, a paper got published that illustrated that point to a greater degree. Okay, I'm out of time. We're going to jump into other texts that the Bible talks about in terms of the end of the universe, basically what we can anticipate in the new creation and what's different about the new creation relative to the previous creation. The study question I just gave you will give you an advanced heads up. And incidentally, those of you new to the class, we actually looked at all the passages in Isaiah that are relevant to the future. And the bad news is, if you're looking for a shortcut for your homework, you're going to have to collect over a third of the verses in Isaiah. That's a lot of what Isaiah deals with. But we collected them for you, and I think they're on the paradoxes.org website. If not, we'll get them there. So with that, let me pray. Father in heaven, we thank you that these prophets of old, living thousands of years ago, were explicit about this creation in which we live right now, how it begins, how it ends, why it is here. And Lord, we look forward to our discussion on why you made the universe the way you did, why it's temporal, why it's not going to last forever. But Lord, we especially appreciate the fact that you designed it to make possible the redemption of billions of human beings, and that we're going to be entering into a new creation where redemption is complete. There will be no need for a universe like ours. There will be no need for gravity, no need for thermodynamics or electromagnetism, and no longer will we be constrained by the dimensions and physics of our universe. We'll be set free to enjoy the wonders of the new creation in a way that's beyond we can think or imagine right now. But Father, I pray that you'd equip each one of us who are followers of Jesus Christ to share with others how they can receive your redemptive offer, how they can be delivered from all the sin and evil in their life, and Lord, have the promise of entry into a realm far better than anything we can experience in this universe. Lord, I pray that you'd have each of us focus on our future hope. Lord, that we would recognize just how great and wonderful, even though it's beyond we can think or imagine, that even at the minimum what we can think and imagine is greater than that. So bless us with that, Lord. Give us time literally every day to meditate on our future reward. In Jesus' name, amen.